This week we're moving on then to Wallace Stevens, and the theme is Ideas of Order. In 1840, a man called Henry Church considered the establishment of a chair of poetry at Princeton University. And to be the professor of this chair, this man, Henry Church, thought of Wallace Stevens. The plan fell through. This chair of poetry was not created at Princeton. But at that time, Wallace Stevens did write a memorandum concerning this project, and this memorandum led to an essay which he later published under the title of The Noble Rider and the Sound of Words. The Noble Rider and the Sound of Words. I'll come back to that essay later. But still thinking in terms of poetic professorships, poetic lecturing, in 1954, some years later, Wallace Stevens was invited, this time by the University of Harvard, to be, for a year, the Charles Eliot Norton Professor of Poetry. By that time, he was 75 years old, still working in an insurance company in Hartford, Connecticut, and wishing to continue to work in the company for several years longer. He declined the year's professorship because he knew if he left the company for a year, it would be difficult for him to come back. But again, he was very, very much interested in the possibility of establishing in universities chairs of poetry, considering that the teaching of poetry was something absolutely necessary. At that time, 1954, for example, he wrote to Archibald MacLeish, another American poet, "One of these things I'm interested in is to try to find out whether it is possible to formulate a theory of poetry that would make poetry a significant humanity of such a nature and scope that it could be established as a normal, vital field of study for all comers." A normal, vital field of study for all comers. And on the same lines, in his book, The Necessary Angel, one of his main essay books, the main essay book, The Necessary Angel, he again speaks of the theory of poetry. The theory of poetry as a subject of study was something with respect to which I had nothing but the most ardent ambitions. It seemed to me to be one of the great subjects of study. I don't mean simply one more ars poetica, one more art poétique, having to do, say, with the techniques of poetry and perhaps with the history of poetry. No, I do not mean that. What I mean is poetry itself, the naked poem, the imagination manifesting itself in its domination of words. What I mean is poetry itself, the naked poem. And in one of his poems, he says this: "They will get it straight one day at the Sorbonne." That's what I've been trying to do. Wallace Stevens was born in Reading, Pennsylvania, 2nd October 1879, and he died in Hartford, Connecticut, August 1956. After studying at Harvard, he continued his studies at the law school in New York, studied law in New York. And he practiced law in New York as from 1904, until in 1916, he entered an insurance company as legal advisor. And he was going to work all his life in this insurance company as legal advisor. His poems appeared for the first time in the Chicago Review Poetry, one of the big American poetry magazines, Poetry, as from 1914. But his first book, he waited a long time for his first book, appeared only in 1923, and this book was entitled Harmonium. Significant title. Wallace Stevens is after a harmony, an order. Harmonium, then, 1923. If his production from that time on is going to be regular, right up to the final publication, which was The Auroras of Autumn, 1960, posthumous publication, followed by The Complete Poems in 1964, this slowness in publishing has a parallel in the slowness with which Stephen's work came to be known. It was a long time before he was recognized as a front-ranking poet. And there are reasons for that. In a hurried civilization, in a hurry, scurrying civilization, a work like his, based on the idea that contemplation is the highest value, could only seem the fruit, a kind of exotic fruit, of some kind of luxury leisure. Stevens is an aesthete, but in a very robust and vital sense of the word, as we'll see. For him, the aesthetic order, in fact, contains all other orders, including the political. But this, of course, is an idea not very frequent in our context. Wallace Stevens' aesthetic activity, his poetic activity, his imaginative activity, that's how he saw it, didn't consist of detaching himself totally from reality, far from it. No more did it mean losing himself in the confusion of reality. It meant establishing a certain distance to reality in order to obtain from the blue guitar is how he refers to poetry and art, and that's the title of another of his books, 1937, The Man with the Blue Guitar, establishing then a certain balanced relationship to reality. He tries to obtain, through art, through poetry, a harmony of life between imagination and reality, a harmony that augments the sense of life, which opens up a new vision of life, which gives life density and light. In other words, aesthetics for him is a vital, robust activity. Not at all the anemic aesthete which we may have in our imaginations. Imagination here is something strong, creating not some kind of fantastic other world, or, on the other hand, simply a proliferation of more or less bizarre images, but a real intensity, an intensity of reality. Poetry for him is the supreme fiction. There's another of his books, Notes Towards the Supreme Fiction, 1951. It is also The Necessary Angel, 1951 again. The language of this necessary angel is scrupulous and exact, out for an absolute clarity. In fact, when I mention this word clarity, let me say that there's something French in Wallace Stevens. He even went so far one day as to say that for him, the English language and the French language were one. French words abound in his texts. He was in correspondence with French poets and philosophers, Jean Val, Jean Paulhan. In France, French thinking meant a great deal to him. Let's say in this little presentation, this initial presentation, that all this, all these ideas I'm putting across for Wallace Stevens had nothing to do with any kind of solemnity. Thinking for him, poetry is not solemn. Poetry for him is a kind of gaiety of language. And poetry means, in fact, happiness. This joy, this joyance, this happiness in creation is for him also a form of knowledge. Probably the highest form of knowledge. And this highest form of knowledge manifests itself in the poem of the idea which is inside the poem of words. Let's look now at this essay I mentioned, which is contained in the book The Necessary Angel, this essay called The Noble Rider and the Sound of Words. It's very much concerned with the relationship between reality and imagination. For him, imagination loses all vitality if it ceases to adhere to what is real. There must be a contact with the real, otherwise imagination becomes mere fantasy, mere mental cinema. If the imagination is to be vital, robust, intense, clear, fluent, all of these words he likes, then there must be a relationship to the real. This distinction between mere fantasia on the one hand and real imagination, if you like, on the other, goes back to some of the Romantic German thinkers, and in the English context, it's Coleridge. Coleridge makes the distinction between, on the one hand, fancy, which is simply putting things together in a superficial kind of way, a superficial operation, and imagination, which, in Coleridge's language, in Coleridge's vocabulary, is this: imagination is the will, as a principle of the mind's being, striving to realize itself in knowing itself. There's a very abstract definition of imagination, but one worth thinking about, one worth meditating. Imagination is the will, as a principle of the mind's being, striving to realize itself in knowing itself. Imagination, then, is concerned with realization and with a certain type of knowledge. It's a notion of imagination which is not current, which is very far from being journalistic. The opposite of fantasy and mental cinema. In this essay, Wallace Stevens takes as an example, as a point of departure, the statue of General Jackson, which stands in Lafayette Square in Washington. And this statue, which may be taken as a kind of emblem of the American mind to some extent, he says, has no imagination in it whatsoever. This is Wallace Stevens speaking. All you can say, says Wallace Stevens, about this statue of General Jackson is that the horse has a beautiful tail. That's the end of it. And he says in his comment that it is obvious, he says, that the American will, as a principle of the mind's being, is easily satisfied in its efforts to realize itself in knowing itself. That the American mind, he says, is too easily satisfied. This is probably true not only of the America, which Wallace Stevens was criticizing because that was where he was living. It's probably true of our whole civilization. There's probably a failure in the relationship between imagination and reality, largely because of the sheer pressure of reality on everybody. The pressure of events. The pressure of journalistic events. And if he's after a kind of nobility, this is a hard word to use, nobility, because we immediately conjure up, 18th century noblemen or something, which was one form of nobility. Obviously, Wallace Stevens is not after that kind of nobility. He's after a new type of nobility. If the word noble is hard to use, the word ignoble is much easier to use. In fact, we probably have no conception of nobility in Stevens' sense, but we certainly know what ignoble is. We're surrounded by it most of the time. So he would say that in modern civilization, there is a blockage. There is a blockage, there's a mental blockage, from which people try to escape in merely fantastic ways. All kinds of romantic incoherence, all kinds of fancy religions, all kinds of mental cinema. These are paltry means of escape, because the real work isn't being done. And why is the real work not being done? Well, because the culture isn't strong enough. This is Wallace Stevens speaking, and I'm speaking with him. The blockage is due partly to half education. Not education, he's for education in the strong sense of the word, but half education is a bad thing, because people lose a kind of freshness of ignorance without achieving the ultimate of education, which is a new kind of ignorance in a way. Another thing that goes against real creativity, which means it goes against the freshness of living, is, in his estimation, politically, the predominance of a middle class, which has largely realistic satisfactions. And then another thing which goes against it is simply that there are so many of us, that we're so close together all the time, that we very rarely have the distance, the breathing space necessary for meditation, contemplation, and work on ourselves. This, in general, can be subsumed under the pressure of reality, the pressure of external events on the consciousness of every one of us, preventing any power of contemplation. The pressure of events, the pressure of news, the pressure of reality. To such an extent that some of the best minds of our civilization, in fact, have proposed have suggested, have advised a surrender to this. They say, don't fight against it, surrender to it. That's largely Freud, for example, puts forward the idea of a surrender to reality, an education to reality. Hegel, the philosopher, said that a modern mind should begin by reading the newspaper every morning. Or Wallace Stevens, when he woke up in the morning, prepared to look at, say, an apple tree or a gull flying in the air rather than read the newspaper. Maybe he read the newspaper later, but certainly not at dawn or when he got up. Within these difficulties, within this difficult situation, Wallace Stevens is trying to realize the figure of a poet, the figure of a real poet, and he suggests that we all try to construct in our minds a possible poetry, a possible poet. This man, this human being, must be able to resist the pressure of reality, which is very difficult for all of us. He must be able to abstract himself to some extent from reality. And this he can do by placing reality in his imagination. Now, who is this person? What is this figure? What is this potential human being? What is the basis for a real poetry, a strong poetry, a poetry which can mean everything to everybody? He refers to the Italian thinker, Benedetto Croce, C-R-O-C-E. And Croce says this, if poetry is intuition and expression, the fusion of sound and imagery, what is the material which takes on the form of sound and imagery? The material, the basic material, is the whole man. And together with the man, integral with him, it is all nature in its perpetual labor of evolution. Let me just read that again because it's important. The basis for any real creative activity, for any real living activity, is the whole man. And together with the man, integral with him, it is all nature in its perpetual labor of evolution. He's a whole human being, and a human being can never be whole unless he also is surrounded by the sheer physical presence of nature in movement. Now, this idea of wholeness is very complex and very difficult. Dr. Joad, a thinker, an English thinker this time, to whom Stevens refers, says this, and Joad is speaking in scientific terms, because we're trying to get into an area where poetry, philosophy, and science all can come together. Joad says this, every quality of a body resolves itself into an enormous number of vibrations, movements, changes. We are not a block of being. We are a complex of vibrations, movements, and changes. What is it that vibrates, moves, or is changed, says Joad? And he says there is no answer to this question. Philosophy has long dismissed the notion of substance, and modern physics has endorsed the dismissal. How then does the world come to appear to us as a collection of solid, static objects extended in space? Because of the intellect, which presents us a false view of it. In other words, reality, the wholeness of nature and human being, is flux, movement, change. But if we have the sense of solid objects, it's because our mind sort of creates the solid objects by a kind of falseness, by a fiction. So solid objects are fictions, probably necessary fictions, because that's our human reality. But let's not lose the fact that while we're concerned apparently with solid objects or with absolute fixed identities, the real reality is movement, is in flux. So while we're concerning solid objects, let's not lose the sense of flux. If our mind is obliged for our normal living to construct, to compose solid objects, identities, let's keep the composition open. Let's keep it an open structure, an open composition. And Wallace Stevens says that the subject of poetry is in fact not solid objects, as it is for a certain kind of painting, for example. The subject of poetry, he says, is life lived in the scene it composes. Life lived in the scene it composes. And this life lived in any place Place is important for Stevens. Life lived in a place or in a space must be lived as finely, as subtly, as lucidly as possible. And it's that fine living which he calls nobility. I mean, nothing to do with 18th century aristocrats or anything like that. But fine living in a place, in a space. That's what he means by nobility. And this nobility is a spiritual height and depth. Very difficult to define. Very evasive, very inaccessible. If you define it too simply, too easily, you fix it. And if you fix it, you deform it, you falsify it. Just as it is with reality. Nobility resolves itself, in fact, says Wallace Stevens, into an enormous number of vibrations, movements, changes. Not an identity, but a play of fine energies. Vibrations, movements, changes. And to fix it too soon, to fix it at any time, in fact, is to put an end to it, is to kill it. So in his essays, in his poetry, he's trying to put forward a sensation of this unfixed fineness, this ecstatic freedom of the mind, freedom and freshness of the mind. Something which is like, say, a wave. You know, a wave is not a mass of water. It looks like a mass of water, but a wave is a force which uses water. Huh? The wave is a force which uses water, the water of which it is composed. So nobility is a force using material, using materia poetica, if you like, but moving beyond it. Using different materials, but still maintaining this beautiful, fine, subtle force. A force, not an artifice. I said that Stevens was an aesthete, but not an aesthete in the artificial sense of the word. Not concerned with artificialities, but with a fine force of thinking, living, and saying. Something violent, even. Something strong and violent. A violence from within, in fact, that can protect the human being from the violence coming from without, coming from society. If you like, it's, in his vocabulary, the imagination pressing back against the pressure of reality. The future poet for him, the real poet, has no social obligations. He has a function, however. And his function is to bring some light to men's minds, he says. To help people, in fact, to live their lives, to quicken their minds. So that eventually the world of poetry would become indistinguishable from the world in which we live, or in world, from the world in which we shall come to live. Since what makes the poet the potent figure that he is or was or ought to be is that he creates the world to which we turn incessantly. He gives to life the supreme fictions without which we are unable to conceive of it. And if we get this type of poetry written, said, and if we're able to propagate this idea of fine living connected with fine doing and with fine saying, then he says we may emerge from our bassesse, and he uses the French word. Having said that, let's look at one of the poems which we have to hand there. The poem called The Ultimate Poem is Abstract. The Ultimate Poem is Abstract. This concerns a man doing a lecture on poetry, or doing a lecture on aesthetics, maybe. But it's a man talking, if you like, from the outside. A man piling up discourse, but never penetrating through to the light. If you like, the intellect doing the lecture here in this poem is a slow, prudent, problematic intellect. Whereas what Stevens is after is a fine, fast, poetic intellect. Let me just read the poem. This day, rise with what? The lecturer of this beautiful world of ours composes himself and hems the planet rose and haws it ripe and red and right. The particular question, here the particular answer to the particular question is not in point. The question is in point. If the day rise, it is not with revelations. One goes on asking questions. That, then, is one of the categories. So said, this placid space is changed. It is not so blue as we thought. To be blue, there must be no questions. It is an intellect of windings round and dodges to and fro, writhings in wrong obliques and distances, not an intellect in which we are fleet, present everywhere in space at once, cloud pole of communication. It would be enough if we were ever just once, just at the middle, fixed in this beautiful world of ours and not as now, helplessly at the edge. Enough to be complete, because at the middle, if only in sense, and in that enormous sense, merely in joy. This lecturer then, this lecturer who's not speaking from the center of his subject from the outside, this problematic intellect rather than a fast poetic intellect, is humming and hawing. Look at the third line. And hems the planet rose and haws it right. He's humming and hawing. He's beating about the bush. Something is trying to get into movement here in this lecture. This day writhes with what? Writhe, a convulsive movement. Something is trying to get into movement, but it is not achieving its real movement. Because this lecturer is a secondary mind. This day writhes with what? The lecturer on this beautiful world of ours, that's his theme, composes himself and hems the planet rose and haws it right. He piles up discourse, but never gets through to the center. He never really says anything. And read and write. The particular question, here the particular answer to the particular question is not in point. The question is in point. He piles up questions. He piles up problems, but he never gets through. He never drives through into the space beyond questions, into the blueness, as Wallace Stevens says. If the day rises, it is not with revelations. There are no revelations in this lecture, simply discourse, simply words being piled up on words. No revelations, no naked vision. It is not with revelations. No presence of somebody actually trying to get somewhere, daring to say something. It is not with revelations. One goes on asking questions. That, then, is one of the categories. Asking questions is one of the categories of thought. But if you merely keep on asking questions, piling up problems, then this placid space, the world, the universe, is changed. You spoil it. You pile up discourse on it. It is not so blue as we thought. You spoil its purity. You spoil its freshness. To be blue, there must be no questions. It is an intellect of windings round and dodgings to and fro. This is a tortuous intellect, as I say, a problematic intellect. Writhings in wrong obliques and distances. Not an intellect in which we are fleet. He's out for a fast, light-footed, clear-sighted intelligence. Not an intellect in which we are fleet. Present everywhere in space at once. If your intellect is really fast, you're present in all places at once, because there's no simple location. If you're here, you can also be in other places. Cloud pole of communication, a kind of electric atmosphere, cloud pole of communication. It would be enough if we were ever just once at the middle, rather than this problematic discourse, rather than this secondary talk, even about interesting questions, it would be better just to enjoy ignorantly. Sheer ignorant joints is better than this phony discourse. It would be enough if we were ever just once at the middle, fixed in this beautiful world of ours, and not as now, helpless at the edge. It would be enough to be complete, because at the middle, if only in sense, and in that enormous sense, merely in joy. Sheer ignorant enjoyment, sheer ignorant pleasure, is better than this secondary discourse. But of course, if you educate your pleasure, if you push your pleasure into more subtle areas, then you can get beyond, first of all, ignorant pleasure, also beyond secondary discourse, you can get into a very, very fine space of living, thinking, being, and saying. And this third space will be a kind of renewal or augmentation of the primal space, without the halfway house, which is the house of phony discourse, false knowledge, half education. This poem, in fact, reminds me of a Zen story, a story of Zen Buddhism, where the path of education, the path of augmenting one's being, because that's what it's all about, is described in the following terms. At the beginning, says this student, shall we say, who's made a lot of progress. In the beginning, he says, mountains were mountains and rivers were rivers. That's the ignorant, fresh, ignorant, simple situation. In the beginning, mountains were mountains and rivers were rivers. At the second stage, when he began to be intellectualistic, the mountains were no longer mountains and the rivers were no longer rivers. But in the third stage, the mountains were again mountains and the rivers were again rivers. So let's look at the mountain and river landscape in which Wallace Stevens liked to live, think, and have his being. He's very much concerned with being situated in a place, in a space. And his chosen place, he wasn't a native to the place, but that doesn't matter. His chosen place, because that's what matters, was Connecticut. Connecticut on the Atlantic seaboard of America. And in a very slight text, but significant text, which he wrote near the end of his life. He wrote it, in fact, in 1955 for the Voice of America. And it was simply a little article on Connecticut. And without reading the article to you in detail, I'd like just to pick out a few salient features of this article, a few significant points. He may be idealizing Connecticut slightly, that doesn't matter. This is his mental space, his physical and mental space. He speaks of the thrift and frugality of the Connecticut Yankee. Thrift and frugality. He speaks also of intelligent ingenuity. These are values which Stevens is out for. Intelligent ingenuity. He speaks also of the high general level of intelligence. A high general level of intelligence. This is his America, if you like. Huh? Separate from what he considers as a general socio-cultural mess. He speaks also of a dignified style of living. A dignified style of living. And at one time, he says, recently, he made a trip through Connecticut. Now keep this trip in mind because it will lead us into the next poem. He says that he made, and I quote, a precious ride through the character of the state. A precious ride through the character of the state. A precious ride through the character of the state. Another phrase I'd like to underline, he speaks of the soil being everywhere thin and difficult. A difficult situation. The soil everywhere thin and difficult. Yet, he says, spring was coming on. And it was as if the people whose houses I was seeing shared the strength that was beginning to assert itself. Spring and a new strength coming in. When the spring was at its height, we should have a watercolor in Connecticut, not an oil. And we should all feel, there's this communal thing, this general thing, we should all feel that we had a hand in the painting of it. If only in choosing to live there where it existed. Another feature I'd like to bring out, he says that Connecticut could be described as an industrial and business center. It's true. Connecticut is an industrial and business center. He says, but if you're satisfied with that definition of Connecticut, you miss out on a whole lot of realities. You miss out on, he says, that would leave out the salt water of Noank and Stonington. It would leave out the hills in which the various Cornwalls are situated. The sense of being on high land, of being on a rich plateau at Pomfret, the rich, rare fields over east, the heights and depths of our western and part of our northern borders, the special river countries of the Housatonic and the Thames. These are the realities he's concerned with. To define Connecticut as an industrial and business center is to be satisfied with a paltry definition and with a paltry reality. He's after all these more subtle, more secluded, more hidden realities. And he says this to know these things, to know these intimate things, this is to come home to America. This is a question of coming home to the American self in the sort of place in which it was formed. Going back to Connecticut, in this sense, is a return to an origin. And this is a theme, of course, which comes up again and again in these lectures and these considerations of a certain American poetry. And Wallace Stevens has a poem, I think it's the last poem he wrote, in fact, which is concerned with maybe even a fragment of a poem. We don't know if it's a poem or a fragment, but it's concerned with this sense of place, this sense of being, of living finally in a clean place, as clean a place as possible. And this fragment begins this way. A mythology reflects its region. Here in Connecticut, we never lived in a time when mythology was possible. But if we had, that raises the question of the image's truth. The image must be of the nature of its creator. It is the nature of its creator increased, heightened. It is he anew in a freshened youth. And it is he in the substance of his region. Wood of his forests and stone out of his fields or from under his mountains. So he's concerned with the mythology of a region. In other words, an imaginative vision of any specific place. And let's look now, with that in mind, at the poem 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird. I think when he had this notion of a space, an aesthetic space, a space of fine living, Wallace Stevens in America must very often have thought of Japan, Japanese culture, very much concerned with the Japanese landscape, and as a context, a specific place, with, at one time at least, and to some extent still, a very, very fine culture connected with that place, with that space. And I think he must have had a look at one aspect of Japanese culture, which is the painting of Hokusai and Hiroshige concerning Fuji, you know, the 50-odd visions of Fuji, which is part of Japanese painting, 50, 60 visions of the one place, 13 ways of looking at a blackbird. And I think also he must have known the Japanese form of poetry, which is the haiku. Haiku, which is a sharp vision of a reality, but allowing meditation. Vision and meditation, that's very much the definition of Wallace Stevens. So with that in mind also, let's look at Wallace Stevens in America and in a modern situation. 13 ways of looking at a blackbird. Among 20 snowy mountains, the only moving thing was the eye of the blackbird. I was of three minds, like a tree in which there are three blackbirds. The blackbird whirled in the autumn winds. It was a small part of the pantomime. A man and a woman are one. A man and a woman and a blackbird are one. I do not know which to prefer, the beauty of innuendos, the beauty of inflections, or the beauty of innuendos, the blackbird whistling, or just after. Icicles filled the long window with barbaric glass. The shadow of the blackbird crossed it to and fro. The mood traced in the shadow an indecipherable cause. Oh, thin men of Haddam, why do you imagine golden birds? Do you not see how the blackbird walks around the feet of the women about you? I know noble accents and lucid, inescapable rhythms, but I know too that the blackbird is involved in what I know. When the blackbird flew out of sight, it marked the edge of one of many circles. At the sight of blackbirds flying in a green light, even the bawds of euphony would cry out sharply. He rode over Connecticut in a glass coach. Once a fear pierced him, in that he mistook the shadow of his equipage for blackbirds. The river is moving, the blackbirds must be flying. It was evening all afternoon. It was snowing, and it was going to snow. The blackbird sat in the cedar limbs. A commentary, a close reading, Among 20 snowy mountains, you have the vast panorama, the whole panoramic presence of the universe, if you like. Among 20 snowy mountains, the whole expanse, the only moving thing was the eye of the blackbird. So you have a sense of expanse, you have a sense of the whole sheer presence of the world, but also a sense of detail. And the detail is not simply the blackbird, but the eye of the blackbird. That's the only moving thing, this small glittering dot in this immensity. So a sense of immensity and a sense of detail, both being necessary. I was of three minds, like a tree in which there are three blackbirds. It's already quite difficult to be in two minds. That means you've got a lot of questions in your mind. To be of three minds means that the questioning is even more complex. I was of three minds, like a tree in which there are three blackbirds. But the situation is concrete, like a tree in which there are three blackbirds. It's not an empty questioning. It's a questioning like a triple presence in a concrete space. The blackbird whirled in the autumn winds. It was a small part of the pantomime. There is the blackbird, which is a single figure in which he is going to, on which he's going to meditate. But the blackbird, let's never forget, is part of a whole scene, part of a whole pantomime, part of the whole panorama. A man and a woman are one. He's after unities. A man and a woman are one. There is a possible unity between a man and a woman. But this unity can be increased. There are greater unities possible. A man and a woman and a blackbird are one. Unities can be extended, can be increased, can be augmented. And you can come finally to a sense of total unity. But it's not easy. I do not know which to prefer. The beauty of inflections or the beauty of innuendos. The blackbird whistling or just after. What's better? Music or the silence that comes after the music? The poem or the mental space in which the poem leads you? Probably you don't need to choose. Both are necessary. The poem should lead to the silence, and the poem itself comes out of a silence. Icicles filled the long window with barbaric glass. I said that, and I insist on this, Wall Stevens is an aesthete, but he's a violent aesthete. His aesthetics is one of force. Icicles filled the long window with barbaric glass. Barbaric glass, rude, rough glass. The shadow of the blackbird crossed it to and fro. The mood traced in the shadow an indecipherable cause. The language is very abstract. It's an abstract kind of grammar. But the idea is the mood traced in the shadow an indecipherable cause. The mind sees only intuitively a certain shadow, a certain presentiment of reality, but via this intuition, via this mood of reality, it posits a cause, an ultimate. O thin men of Haddam, why do you imagine golden birds? But this ultimate is not a fanciful reality. There's no need to create golden birds. It's enough to insist on an ordinary bird, a blackbird. A blackbird is enough. An ordinary, real bird is sufficient for an ultimate meditation. You don't need golden birds. You don't need fancy birds. You don't need ideal birds. It's nothing to do with the ideal. It's a question of subtly seeing things as they are, but seeing them subtly and wholly. Do you not see how the blackbird walks around the feet of the women about you? Women in this would be more realistic than men. While the men are indulging in their ideal visions, the women apparently have their feet on the ground the way the blackbird has. I know noble accents and lucid, inescapable rhythms, but I know too that the blackbird is involved in what I know. Human knowledge is fine, but human knowledge is not complete unless the whole of the world comes into it. When the blackbird flew out of sight, it marked the edge of one of many circles. Any single locality is united with all localities. There's no simple location. When the blackbird flew out of sight, it marked the edge of one of many circles. You can begin anywhere, and if your thinking is large enough, subtle enough, you're going to go from circle to circle into the total circle. At the sight of blackbirds flying in the green dawn, even the bards of euphony would cry out sharply. There's an imagistic idea of poetry. The image, a sharp image, can be as arresting as mellifluous poetry. And in fact, Stevens, like other poets we've been considering, tends to move away from mellifluous verse towards sharp vision, the sharp vision of some thing. At the sight of blackbirds flying in a green light, there's the image, even the bawds of euphony, even the prostitutes of mellifluous verse would realize that something important was happening, something significant. He rode over Connecticut in a glass coach. Once a fear pierced him in that he mistook the shadow of his equipage for blackbirds. You can become so absorbed in your meditation that you forget everything else. And it can become an obsession. And that's what is happening here. He becomes afraid that he's seeing blackbirds everywhere. The meditation is becoming an obsession. The river is moving. The blackbirds must be flying. Everything is interconnected. If the river's moving, the blackbird is flying. There should be no blockage anywhere. There should be a moving universe, a beautiful moving universe, with everything flowing in its own way. It was evening all afternoon. It was snowing, and it was going to snow. I said that Wallace Stevens was not so much an admirer of mellifluent verse, but he is an admirer and a practitioner of beautiful language, and there it is. It was evening all afternoon. It was snowing, and it was going to snow. These O's and these S's give you the sense of contemplation. The blackbird sat in the cedar limbs. The blackbird then, the poet or the writer or the reader, for that matter, becomes in fact identified at the end with the blackbird sitting in the cedar limbs, sitting in a kind of meditative posture with the whole of the world in front of him. Wallace Stevens then is very much a meditative poet, very much a thinking poet. Not that he writes philosophy in verse. That's not what I mean. He's after a kind of thinking, a kind of meditation that gives the mind sudden life, that opens up vistas, that gives flashes of reality. Not thinking for thinking's sake, but thinking for clearing the eyes. He says all of us, poets in the first instance, but everybody is a whole, part of a whole. And this whole, for the most part, we have no language for. So the question is of finding a concept adequate to this whole and finding words to say this whole, to say one's presence in the whole. The mind, everybody's mind, is after some kind of integration, some kind of wholeness. We all want that. Most of the time we don't find it. Poetry and philosophy are both trying to get at it. Philosophy will tend to be more metaphysical. It will tend to be more divorced, if you like, from concrete situations. Whereas poetry will be much more connected with land, with the physical ambience. And he says this in a lovely phrase concerning the possible union of poetry and philosophy, that the wing of poetry should also be the rushing wing of meaning seems to me an extreme aesthetic good. And so in time and perhaps in other politics, it may come to be. His own poetry considers a kind of adumbration or an approach to this reality in which everything would be poetic. And this means poetic work such as it is very rarely practiced. The poet of the future, he says, cannot simply be an eccentric in society, cannot be dissociated, cannot simply be casual, cannot simply be an intermittent creator. He must work at this thing fundamentally and long towards an approach to a larger logic, to a harmony and order. And this will mean for everybody, in the end, the change from a lesser life to a greater one. Let's look at the last poem, which is concerned with these perspectives. And it's the poem which begins at the earliest ending of winter. I didn't make this an absolute demand to myself, but I had the idea that I would try and arrange these poems roughly in accordance with the seasons. And this is a poem about March. Okay, I'm a bit out because we're still in February, but spring this year is precocious. So the end of February, to some extent, is March. This is a poem concerning landscape and mindscape, concerned with the relationship between outside and inside. At the earliest ending of winter, in March, a scrawny cry from outside seemed like a sound in his mind. He knew that he heard it, a bird's cry, at daylight as before, in the early March wind. The sun was rising at 6, no longer a battered panache above snow. It would have been outside. It was not from the vast ventriloquism of sleep's faded papier-mâché. The sun was coming from outside. That scrawny cry. It was a chorister whose sea preceded the choir. It was part of the colossal sun, surrounded by its choral rings, still far away. It was like a new knowledge of reality. At the earliest ending of winter then, in this difficult, harsh situation, there is this cry, a scrawny cry. It's not the mellifluous call of a nightingale. It's a scrawny cry. It's something raucous, something rude and raucous, a scrawny cry from outside, seemed like a sound in his mind, and outside and inside seem in connection. He knew that he heard it, a bird's cry at daylight or before, in the early March wind. The sun was rising at 6. Then you have the general situation. The sun was rising at 6. It's early morning, in the freshness of beginning things. No longer a battered panache above snow. The sun rising now is no longer a battered panache, no longer a confusion. It's beginning to achieve form, beginning to achieve its perfect form. It would have been outside. So he surmises that this sound was coming to him from the whole of the world, from outside. It was not from the vast ventriloquism of sleep's faded papier-mâché. It wasn't a dream. It wasn't a fantasy. It wasn't part of his mental cinema. It was something which is part of the reality of the world, but which is at the same time related to, speaking to, calling out something from inside him. The sun was coming from outside. That scrawny cry, this rude, raucous, unpretentious cry, sound, was a chorister whose sea preceded the choir. From this small beginning, from this insignificant beginning, it may be possible to achieve a whole harmony, a whole order, a chorister whose sea preceded the choir. It was part of the colossal sun, part of the hugeness, the universality, the totality, the wholeness of things, surrounded by its choral rings, still far away. It was like a new knowledge of reality. That's what we're concerned with then, a new knowledge of reality. And before we leave Wallace Stevens this morning, I'd like you to read you just a few aphorisms which he wrote near the end of his life. Aphorisms concerning life, thinking, and poetics. And I'll just read them without any commentary. The title he gave to these aphorisms was Adagia. Adagia. And here are some of them, just a selection. The highest pursuit is the pursuit of happiness on earth. The highest pursuit is the pursuit of happiness on earth. Another one, they're just short aphorisms. Literature is the better part of life. To this, it seems inevitably necessary to add, provided life is the better part of literature. Another, the individual partakes of the whole, except in extraordinary cases he never adds to it. Poetry increases the feeling for reality. Poetry increases the feeling for reality. To live in the world, but outside of existing conceptions of it. To live in the world, but outside of existing conceptions of it. It is not every day that the world arranges itself in a poem. It is not every day that the world arranges itself in a poem. The aesthetic order includes all other orders, but is not limited to them. The world is the only fit thing to think about. The world is the only fit thing to think about. Every poem is a poem within a poem, the poem of the idea within the poem of the words. To be at the end of fact is not to be at the beginning of imagination. It is to be at the end of both. To be at the end of fact is not to be at the beginning of imagination. It is to be at the end of both. And then finally, I'll just leave you with this. One cannot spend one's time in being modern when there are so many more important things to be. One cannot spend one's time in being modern when there are so many more important things to be. Okay, thanks.